This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Raise Your Game on Enterprise. I'm Christine Wong. This is part one of Managing Mindsets, a four-part series where I speak to George Aveling, CEO of TMI Consultancy, a consulting and learning company with offices in over 50 countries around the world. Now, George is no stranger to the BFM studios. He's been on countless times talking about a lot of different things. But with this series, we're going to be talking about concepts that have to do with changing your mindset about something or changing someone else's mindset about something. So when it comes to business, sometimes it's difficult to understand decisions that consumers and even fellow business associates can make. You would think that we would choose the best stuff for ourselves or the best choices for ourselves, but that's not always the case. And that can be very difficult to understand. However, there is a body of knowledge that is dedicated to figuring all of this out, and it's called behavioral economics. It's all about the psychology of decision-making as consumers and in business. So George is here with me today to talk about how we can use these principles to influence behavior and how can we use that science to create a stronger business. So this behavioral economics concept, what actually is this concept and what is so interesting about behavioral economics?
Okay, so behavioral economics is all about the psychology of decision-making. And there are some concepts that we'll talk about.
Nice. Yep. All right. I mean, obviously, we can't cover every single thing in this really, really wide topic, but we're going to try and get the gist of the thing. What exactly can you get from behavioral economics?
It depends on who you are. Let's play a little quiz here.
All right. Quiz away.
Okay. You're a marketer, mm-hmm. right? And you've said to me, I've got this product, I've advertised it, but it's not selling. So it's selling at a price of 249 ringgit, and I can't sell it. What would the advice be?
Probably to lower the price, I
lower
assume.
The price, yeah. Okay. So therefore, a behavioral economist would look at it differently. There is a concept called anchoring, and anchoring is about I would anchor the consumers at a higher price. In fact, this is what happened with a bread maker in the United States, William Sonoma. They made a bread maker, $249 US, wasn't selling. So what did they do? They produced another bread maker, which was priced at $429. So people would go, wow, $249 sounds like good value. And so therefore they sold a lot of those bread makers. So it's very practical advice, which is counterintuitive because what we think is people think rationally. When price goes up, demand goes down, etc. But in fact, behavioral economics says that you make irrational decisions, but you do it in a predictable manner. And that's why behavioral economics helps you to understand that predictably irrational behavior.
So in this case, the irrational behavior is seeing what is an expensive product, but when put in the perspective of comparison to an even more expensive version of that product, suddenly that one's like, oh, that's quite reasonable.
That's right.
Right,
that's right.
I see.
I've seen there's a major retailer in Kuala Lumpur. It uses this at Christmas time. You know, they sell the Christmas hampers, all the goodies in the baskets. Now, they go for, you know, let's say 329 ringgit, 350, but they've always got one which is 1700 ringgit. And they know that they are unlikely to sell the 1700 ringgit basket, but they know that that will make the other baskets look good
cheaper,
value,
yeah.
And they sell more.
So thinking about, let's say, taking it from a marketing perspective and pushing it to more a sales perspective, how does it help the actual sales department?
Okay, let's say that I'm a salesperson.
All right.
Let's say I'm a car salesperson. Now, because I know the principles of behavioral economics, I will make a higher average commission than other people. And it goes like this. Again, I anchor people around a high price to start off with. And there is another concept which is called loss aversion. You don't want to lose something. So it goes like this. If you're inexperienced at selling a car, let's say it's car X, and it costs 350,000 ringgit. The base model is $350,000, but if you want the quadraphonic stereo, it's an extra $5,000. If you want those contour leather seats, it's another $5,000. So you start off with a low price and add things onto it, right? Now, a salesperson who understands behavioral economics will say the fully optioned car costs 410,000 ringgit. But if you do not want your quadraphonic stereo, we will take off 5,000. If you do not want those special contour seats, we will take off another 5,000. So what happens here is psychologically, people are being anchored around a high price and then they are expecting it to pay a high amount. But they don't want to feel that they're losing all of these options, whereas the first salesman was anchoring people around a low price. Everything else starts to seem expensive.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, hey, here is the full menu with all the options and you can have this at this price, as opposed to you can build up
exactly.
things. Because usually when you give people the option to build things up like that, they will usually be like, I'm okay with the basic stuff.
Because you've anchored them around a basic price.
Mm-hmm.
Versus anchored them around a high price.
Right.
And the anchoring is a critical concept in behavioral economics.
Mm. That's so fascinating, though. I think that, you know, we do see a lot of this, even if we're not aware of it. And, you know, I think that point about customers making irrational decisions, but that those decisions are predictable, is really interesting. Can you tell us a little bit more about why don't we make rational decisions in the first place, do you think?
Well, you know, look, it gets around, emotion plays a big role in this, right? And so therefore, this is where emotion is critical. Let me give you another simple example, right, where emotion is very important, right? If there is this, the concept of a free trial works really well because paying money hurts emotionally. So what happens is a free trial enables you to defer the pain, but you max out on the pleasure of the use of the product. And not only that, what happens is when you've had something to use, let's say for 30 days, you feel this sense of ownership and you don't want to give it back. So a free trial works on two bases, right? Free trial, if you don't want it, you can give it back, or you pay now and you bring it back. But let's say free trial. I've saved you the pain. And secondly, I've got a sense of ownership. I don't want to lose it. Many years ago, when I was in Western Australia, the local newspaper said, we will give you 6 months of this newspaper for free. We thought, this is fantastic. What, 6 months? And we'll cancel it at the end of the 6 months because I haven't needed it in the past. At the end of the 6 months, this became a part of my lifestyle. And so therefore, I continued it on. But this is one of the mistakes that companies make. They say, we will give you a one-week trial, a free trial. That time does not enable the person to feel a sense of ownership. What they should do is let them try it for a month or 2 months. And then when the people feel this is a part of who I am, part of my lifestyle, they don't want to give it back.
So it's essentially creating a kind of dependence on this product or this service without the cost, without the commitment, essentially, of having to pay actual money. And once that's been built kind of into your brain as something that, oh, you need now because you have it, then you're like, oh, maybe I should pay for this because it's been a part of my life for so long already.
Yeah, in behavioral economics terms, it's called the high value of ownership. You value what you own much more than another person would. Right? Mm. So it's a same thing as why do people, they've bought their, you know, an antique. They will value their antique because they own it much more than other people. There's a concept called the IKEA effect. And the IKEA effect is, you know, while people, they make, you take all these, the flat packs home, and then you build it yourself, and you feel this great sense of ownership and love towards your IKEA product. There's a very successful teddy bear chain called Build-A-Bear in the US.
I know that well.
And I have built two bears. And I love these bears because I built them. I put a heart in the bear. I built it. I just love it's called Elvy because I made Elvy in Las Vegas, right? Elvy, you know, I didn't put Elvy in the suitcase coming back to Malaysia. I carried Elvy and he had sunglasses and it was like a little child. People said, oh, look at the teddy bear. He's my little teddy. That's Elvy. I'd built Elvy.
Thing is, I can definitely relate to that because that was the exact same thing, exact same company and everything. When I was younger, I begged my parents to bring me to Build-A-Bear because I didn't know what it was. I just knew that, you know, it sold toys, but you could be involved in the process somehow. And I made a stuffed rabbit called Mimsy, and it, like, you know, you put the heart in and they give you a birth certificate.
That's
and
right.
It's completely, it totally, you know, messes with your head and you feel so responsible for this product, but you paid for it. You just happened to be around during the process, right?
Yeah.
When we moved, it was so hard for me to let go because I kept feeling like, oh, this is something that I created. This is something that belongs to me. And I can't let her go even though her voice box is ruined and now she talks like a zombie, right?
Yeah. So let me give you another example in business.
Mm.
It is creating ownership through choice. There was an experiment where people were given they were given injections. And under one condition, they were told, put out your arm, put out your left arm, and then they were given the injection. Under the second condition, it's called a phlebotomist, the person giving the injection said, tell us which arm you would like us to give the injection to. And the perception of pain was lower when they had a choice. So the principle here is when you give your customers a sense of choice, we can help you. You can build your option set, even for us, let's say in training. You give them the choice of building something versus here it is. They will feel greater ownership and satisfaction when they've felt that they've had a choice in building it. That's that feeling of ownership.
Right. Really, really fascinating. But it's time for a short break. After this, I'll be back with George Aveling to discuss a little bit more about how behavioral economics can factor into customer service. So stay tuned to Enterprise on BFM 89.9.
Be firmly motivated. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to Raise Your Game on Enterprise. I'm Christine Wong. This is part one of Managing Mindsets, which is a four-part series that will be playing throughout March. And I'm here with George Aveling, who is the CEO of TMI Consultancy. Today, we are speaking about the concept of behavioral economics. Now, before the break, we were talking about all this stuff that behavioral economics influences when it comes to business. Things like the concept of anchoring and the concept of loss aversion and all the stuff that really puts things into perspective. Even the concept of, let's say, pricing something at $24.99, right? In our heads, we're like, oh, it's like 24. It's not, it's 25. But because you see the 99 thing, you're like, oh, that's just you round down and it's all fine, right? So it's little things like this that really mess with people's psychology when it comes to business that we might not necessarily think about. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about how that applies to customer service because so far we've discussed how it applies to marketing and sales and a little bit about how it applies to even stuff outside of business as well. But when it comes to customer service, I'm just curious, how does that work with that? Because instead of necessarily selling a product or selling a service or something like that, this is like a social interaction. So how does that work?
Okay, I'm going to give you three concepts. Segment the pleasure, combine the pain, and end on an uptick. All right. Now, I want you to imagine that you're on a long-haul flight. Right. And so therefore you're wondering what are you going to do, you watch a movie, then the meal comes and you get everything at once. You get all the goodies and then, you know, it's all there, all lovely sweet, and then they take it away and nothing else happens. Right. Now I want you to consider scenario B, where you start off, you get on the flight, then they give you maybe the peanuts, which they do, maybe a little bit something different, okay. And then your meal comes, and then sometime after that, they give you an ice cream or they give you something else. And The question is, under which condition would you be more satisfied? One where you get all the everything at one time, or where they spread it out over a period of time? And the research shows that when you spread the joy, when you segment the joy, then you'll get a higher level of customer satisfaction, right? So segment the pleasure, combine the pain. I want you to imagine that you've got a bit of a wound and you've got a plaster on it and it needs to be changed. The question is, would you prefer me to pull your plaster off really slowly, or would you prefer me to rip it off fast? Which one?
The ripping it off thing, yeah.
Okay. So therefore, in the same thing goes. Let's say that I'm in insurance, let's say, and I say, Christine, about this claim that we're talking about, I would let you know very quickly about all the, I need to combine the pain. This hasn't happened. We have not been able to get through this. However, then we move on to the rest of the meeting. Rather than, look, I tell you this bit, and look, I'm a bit too afraid to talk to Christine, so I'll send her a letter a little bit later on, email. What I'm doing is I'm segmenting the pain, all right?
Right.
Which is not a good thing to do.
So when it comes to the positive aspects of, I guess, a social transaction in that way, it's to create this sense of consistent, constant positivity to make sure that the pros are kind of always in the back of your head, whereas with the cons, it's just rip it off, rip off the Band-Aid in one shot and get it out of the way, and then you can focus on all the good stuff again.
But what you do, for example, let's say there's a new customer, uh-huh. Right? So there's a new customer, you give them a new customer experience, and then what you might do is you send them a nice whatever. You might be a little package or an email. Welcome, really glad to have you. So in other words, instead of just the initial meeting, glad to have you as a new customer, you're segmenting it by adding another element to it. So segmenting means you divide the pleasure. Instead of giving one big amount of pleasure, you divide it into a number of different episodes. And then it becomes, end on an uptick. So end on an uptick, the question is, what do people remember? All right. And they remember high points and they remember the last point. So if you were to go to Disneyland, your aim is to end on an uptick where people are waving you goodbye and you've got this great memory. I'll give you a great example. Punk All Out Resort does this really well. Punk All Out Resort, you go there and to leave, you have to get onto a boat, all right? And there are staff members who are walking you down to the boat. It's really nice. Then they put you on the boat. The boat takes off and you turn back. You're 50 meters away. They're waving you, right? You're 150 meters away. You're waving you. They're waving you goodbye. They're still on the dock. You're 350 meters away. They're getting smaller and smaller and they're waving you. So what they're doing is making sure that you feel special even to the very end. Again, using the airline example, right now, it's okay. Thank you, come again. There is an opportunity to create a moment when people get off the plane. Wow, to create a memorable moment. It might well be that instead of them being within, all of them being within the cabin, they're at the end of the walkway. Have a wonderful trip. You'll enjoy Kuala Lumpur. Wow, that's ending on an uptick.
I've had a similar experience, for example, like at a hotel where instead of just saying like, okay, check out, give back the card, whatever, it was like, oh, okay, I hope you enjoyed your stay. Let us know if you, I hope you come back soon to visit and we'll let you know about all these stuff. And that was kind of like, oh, that's nice. Usually it's such a wordless transaction, but this was a little bit of a personal thing. And that made that interaction all the more sweeter.
Yeah. So if you're a service provider, the question is, with your customers, how can you end a phase of the transaction on an uptick so people walk away with a really positive memory?
And, again, all this stuff that we're discussing, I think as people listen to this, they'll start to think about, where have I actually seen this in my life? Because all this stuff it's so familiar, and yet you don't really think about it until you put it into these words, right? And you understand that it's part of this concept of behavioral economics as well. Just one last thing is that you mentioned a really interesting point that I am very curious about, because the claim is that behavioral economics can give us messages on how we can get professionals to donate their time for free. What does that mean? How does that work?
So there's a concept called social norms versus market norms. A market norm is I do something because there's money involved, right? For example, I go to someone's house and my friend's mother's house and I say, Auntie, thank you very much. That was a lovely meal. I'm going to give you 50 ringgit for the trouble. How would she feel? In most cases, they'd feel insulted, in fact.
Oh, okay.
They'd feel insulted.
Maybe I'm just kind of greedy.
That's right. Maybe. So it's, I made this because I wanted to. A social norm is when you say, that was wonderful, thank you very much. So what happens is with lawyers, this is the research. There's an organization, they asked lawyers to provide their services and they said, look, we know, we can't afford to pay you, but we'll pay you $30 an hour. That was an insult to them because now they are getting down to market norms. It was a transaction. The lawyer doesn't want to give their time based on a transaction. But the social norm is you're going to be doing a lot of good for people, right? We really need you. We value you. And so you're moving from the market norm to the social norm. And when you work on social norms, then you'll have a much higher probability of getting those people to give their services for free.
All right. And right before we wrap up, what's your kind of final takeaway on behavioral economics?
It's an interesting area. An author that I really like, Dan Ariely. Ariely. He's entertaining. Check him out on YouTube, and he will add value to your life as a leader, as a parent, and also in your business. So it's definitely worth reading and watching.
All right, fantastic. Well, that's all the time that we have for now, but tune in next week for part two of Managing Mindsets on Raise Your Game, which is again a four-part series with me, Christine Wong, and George Aveling, CEO of TMI Consultancy. In part two, we'll be talking about the problem of sloppy work, its prevalence in Malaysia, and how to overcome it. If you've missed any of this interview or you want to listen again, do download the BFM app. You can listen to the podcast on the Apple App Store or Google Play. This has been Raise Your Game on Enterprise. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.